Well, you know, in a relay race, if you're watching track and field, every runner in a relay race carries a baton. The most likely time for that baton to be dropped is not when the runner is running, but when he is transferring it from one runner to the next. This actually happened in the 2004 Summer Olympics. There was a team that was ahead, and they dropped the baton and lost the race. And so it is with transferring spiritual responsibility from one generation to the next. The most dangerous time there, and the enemy knows this, is in that transfer. Children, I should say, are important, but they're not the sole importance. And what I mean by that is we often talk about, you know, children are the church of the future and so on. But if the present generation is doing its job, we don't really have to worry so much about the church of the future. It will have a good foundation. What we really need to be focusing on is what is the church of today doing? And are we doing our job and living and serving and teaching the way that we should? So if we fulfill our responsibility as the church of tomorrow, the children of the future will be given all that they are needed to do, all that they are needed to build upon. And whether they do that or not, we can't help that, but they have been given everything they need. The home is a testing ground for the worthiness of any religion. If your religion doesn't work at home, it just doesn't work. Okay, so of course your religion works here. We're all on our best behavior right now. Everyone's watching us, and we're all watching each other, and we're making sure, you know, everything's going right. But your home is really the testing ground. Sometimes we place a lot of emphasis on the church services, and yet a small emphasis on the home environment. And sometimes we might be content to let things slide at home, as long as our outward appearances are good. That's a recipe for failure, and we're trying our best, I hope, to avoid that. Parents, Christian parents, who take their role seriously, focus on both. They focus on what's going on here. They also focus on what's going on in the home, not one without the other. So really, this whole series is to be that kind of parent. Be the parent that is interested in what's going on here when we come together, but also be the parent that's very interested in promoting what we're doing here in the home, and carrying that forward in your own personal, private environment. So we ask you, how is your race going, parents? How is your home life? Are you handing off something good to your children? How is that baton transfer going there? I hope that in the children among us here, of any age, that there are future deacons, elders, preachers here in this group. I really hope so. But the only way that we can know for certain that we are preparing such people is if they are being rightly prepared by their parents and by us as mentors. We want to have them properly prepared, properly ingrained with the right thinking for that kind of preparation for the future. Proactive parents are always preparing the next generation, passing that baton there. They live their faith, they teach their convictions, they preach Jesus. Really, the number one objective after your own salvation, even before evangelizing the world, is really your marriage and then evangelizing your home. So I want you to think about that. Are you evangelizing your home? Are you preaching the word of God at your home, in your home environment? That's where it should be spoken first. You know, often we turn to Proverbs 22:6. You've seen it up here several times. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he's old, he will not depart from it. That's not a law. It is a general life principle or proverb. That's why it's in the book of Proverbs. Okay. But there's no guarantees here, and it doesn't remove responsibility either. Really, there's two meanings that we could take from that. First, train the child in the way that he should go, he personally, taking into account your children's or child's own personality, individuality, strengths and weaknesses, temperament, how he's wired, you know, what he's affected by most. You, parent, know your children better than anyone else. And so capitalize on their strengths and help them with their weaknesses, okay? So that's the first thing to think about. The second thing is not contradictory to that. It's to train the children in the way that all children should go. They should all go toward God. They should all be moving toward God. Bring your children up in the nurture and admonition or discipline and instruction of the Lord, because that's where all children should be groomed to be going in the future. I'm not saying that we need to get them baptized now. What I'm saying is that we need to train them what baptism is all about and that commitment to God and that life with Christ. Train them in that way. Regardless, there is no unique gospel or path that is custom tailored for your child, gospel designed exclusively for your child. And I hope that we do not try to create one. That is not our job, to create some kind of customized gospel that just meets your particular child's sensitivities, etc. I know a lot of parents out there in the world are thinking that way right now. I need to find a church, you know, where Junior and Susie can, you know, feel very comfortable and so on. We've actually had people come here visiting, looking for a church for their children. You should be looking for a church for yourself, and really you should be looking for the truth, and then instilling in your children that truth and the responsibilities of that church. Sometimes people have it backward. Such training cannot be passive. It can't just be church going and association with good people. It has to be active. It has to be habitual. It has to be deliberate. You can't train your children for the Olympics, for example, simply by having them watch videos of other people running or by sitting down alongside those who are in the Olympics there. That's not going to do it by itself. First, you have to teach them how to run, and then you have to enter them in the race. So let's just think about that. I mean, what we're doing right now is good. This is all good for our kids. They need this exposure, if you will. They need this environment. This is a good, safe place for our kids. But this isn't the whole of it. This is just simply one aspect of it. There has to be training. There has to be entering the race. Don't say something like, well, someday, you know, we as a family, we'll sit down, we'll study, we'll read, we'll pray together. That's not good enough, because you should know as well as I do that someday will never come. That there will always be something else to sit there and want to take the precedent or take the place. Petty little concerns, whatever they are, they're all going to try to rush in to fill the gap. Nature abhors a vacuum, and so does your spiritual nature. If you don't fill it with something good, something else is going to come in there. That's just the way that things are. Someday will be the epitaph on the headstone of many spiritual dysfunctional families. Someday. Parents, you don't have all the time in the world. And the longer that you wait, the more difficult it will be, and the less likely you will make the right impact. Meanwhile, the world is sitting there waiting, rubbing its hands together, gleefully waiting to train your children for you. If you don't do something, if you're not doing something, then you can better believe that the world is waiting to do something for you instead of you, and it will not be what you want. And even if you're starting late, perhaps you're a new convert with children and you're starting late in the game here, it's better than doing nothing at all. It's better than just going, oh, well, you know, we didn't strive to do this from the beginning, so what's the point? Don't think like that. Just do what you can. You know, many people teach their children how to tie their shoes and dress themselves, how to use a computer and how to ride a bike, drive a car, even how to order their own coffee, how to shoot a gun, how to fish a stream. All those are excellent things, but you've got to understand that those are all things that godless parents teach their children too. I'm not saying they're bad. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just simply saying that if you do that, then you've only done what godless parents do. What you really want to do is what godless parents won't do, and that is teach your children about God and teach them to study the Bible and teach them how to love God and teach them how to live for Jesus, teach them how to surrender their heart to the Lord for all the right reasons. I guarantee you the godless parents are not going to do that, and if you do that for your kids, then they will not turn out most likely to be godless parents. So think about this. You have a lot of effect here, a lot of things to do, but a lot of positive effect as well. We're told in Hebrews 12, verse 1, to let us run the race that is set before us. Well, you, Christian parents, are running now, but hopefully you want your children to run with you. In fact, you want them to run long after you. There's that baton being handed to them. In a relay race, what's interesting is that every runner has his or own little race, but they all carry the same baton, and that's what links them all together. They're all running together in the sense that, you know, everyone runs its part and then hands that baton and then they run and then they hand that baton, and that's the way it should be. If you think about that as far as one generation or one, you know, a group of people, the parents here handing the baton to their children and then those children having children and handing the baton to their children and so forth, that's the way it should be. That's what God intends for us to do. And, of course, to make other converts along the way, not just focusing on ourselves. The baton really here is the collective of divinely revealed truth and godly love and moral responsibility, including keeping commandments. It's the essential ingredients for life with God and an excellent future. By the way, something that we should be speaking well of, not speaking disparagingly of, or speaking of it in a hopeless or negative way, like, well, that's what the preacher always says, or that's what the Bible teaches, but, you know, or something of that nature. That's downgrading something that is very good. The baton is not your complaints or your grudges or your resentments or your negative outlook in life or negative outlook on the brethren, by the way. Many children have been handed that baton rather than the other. A bunch of preachers have been meeting every couple months here, and one of the preachers that was there was talking about referencing the conservative church's viewpoints on certain things in this Puget Sound area in the last 50, 60 years. And one of the things he said really struck with me. He says, I have not always been handed the truth. I have been handed the previous generation's fears, the previous generation's bigotry, and the previous generation's prejudices. And that's the baton that he says he was handed. And it has not served him well, as opposed to being handed the gospel truth. I want you to take that to heart. You know, what exactly are we handing our children? We're saying, well, we're handing off the baton. Yeah, but whose baton is it? Who came up with that baton? Whose baton does that belong to? If it's God's, then it will be good. If it's yours, it won't be so good. So you want to make sure that you're handing the right thing off. Make sure the baton you're passing is the right one, not something you designed, but something that came from God. Now, this next point here might seem to come out of the blue, but it's really tied into all of what we've been talking about, and that is you can spend a lot of time dwelling, even doting on your children, and you might think that's all fine and good, and that your marriage can slide all that time when you're working with your kids, and then when they move out of the home, then you're going to return to your marriage, and all's going to be well, right? It's not. You cannot take care of your kids at the expense of your marriage. Do not give your marriage, parents, a back seat in order to throw all your time and energy to your kids. And by the way, when I say kids, I don't mean just, you know, what you're doing at home and those activities. But I'm talking about the sports thing. I'm talking about all the different activities, especially when they get in high school, all those things going on and all, you know, driving, chauffeuring, everything else. It is very easy for your marriage to suffer dearly in the midst of all that. And you might justify it and say, well, it's all for the benefit of the kids. And that hurts the kids because you're teaching the wrong message. And they're probably going to carry that wrong message into their marriages and think that that's okay. And it also hurts your own marriage, the relationship that you chose, that you courted, that you set above all other relationships in the world. The children were never meant to replace that. They were never meant to replace your marriage or even to equal it. The emptiness syndrome is real, where two people doted on their kids while their kids were young, but then they let their own love and romance die, and now they are faced with basically three options as they see it. We can be miserable for the rest of our lives, or we can just live two disconnected lives in the same house and be roommates, or we can just get a divorce. And this happens to Christian parents who, with all good intentions, did so much sacrificing for their kids and in the process sacrificed themselves. There's a lesson here from history as we move on with this thought here. After 40 years of preparation in the wilderness, the conquest of most of Canaan and settlement in that land, occupation of the cities and abundance of herds and crops, Israel seemed off to a very good start for many generations to come. I want you to compare that to congregations as well as families. There might be a sense of, well, we've done so much and we've arrived here and all is good. And yet you read here in Judges chapter 2, this harrowing verse here, verse 10, it says, all that generation were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. Well, what happened? Well, clearly, they dropped the baton. In fact, you can almost hear it hitting the ground right here in this verse. You can just hear it. What went wrong? Was the system wrong? The law that God gave to Israel, was that defective somehow? Well, no, that wasn't the problem. Were the sacrifices and festivals just too imposing, too burdensome? No, that wasn't the problem either. Is it because there was no teen classes or no youth ministry? No, that wasn't the problem either. Really, it boils down to three basic things. First of all, the older parents, the older generation, did not teach their children how to love God. They only taught them about their religion. They taught the details of sacrifices and ordinances of law, but they didn't teach them what Deuteronomy 6:5 says, is to love the Lord your God with your heart and soul and mind. And that's what they failed to convey there. I talked about this in last week's lesson. You can't just train your children how to go to Bible class and sit on pews and sing songs and participate in church service. I mean, there's a time for all that, of course, but there has to be something so much more than that. Teach your children how to love God with all their heart, their soul, and their might. That's something that you have to teach them. We parents and grandparents cannot assume that children are going to pick this up with the other. Well, they're here in a good environment, right? That's, remember, just like the thing where you're teaching them how to run like an Olympian runner here. Well, we'll just sit them down next to Olympian runners, and we'll show them videos about runners, and they'll pick it up. They'll pick it up over time. No, you actually have to train them how to run. The younger generation was the other problem. They didn't listen to the godly instruction when it was given. The instruction of the older generation and of the word itself. And this is because, well, they were handed everything up front. They didn't have to endure like their parents did. They weren't tested. And they gave attention to lesser things. They simply did not value the things that they were handed. Are we facing this today? Yeah, we are. Okay, we're facing this very much today. These are same struggles that we face today. Regardless, parents need to teach young people what to value and how to value it. Young people have the responsibility to listen and to take this seriously, as opposed to what your unspiritual friends and peers are saying, who think that they know better. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 24 and 25, is all part of the law. Moses says, the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always and our survival. It will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all these commandments. Righteousness for us if we do this. Well, nothing's really changed. Different covenant, same message, same expectations. Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 26 through 28. Moses says, I'm setting you before you today, rather, a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you listen to the commandments. The curse, of course, if you do not listen to the commandments and turn aside. Well, here it is. We're doing the same thing today. Hopefully with our kids, we're setting before them a blessing and a curse. And I'm not saying all in one day, but I'm saying, you know, as a lifestyle, we're saying, here's the right path. You should choose this. This leads to life. This is good. This will be your salvation. This will be your righteousness. Or if you want to be like the rest of the world, here's the path that leads to destruction and leads to your spiritual misery and your doom in the end. You have the right to choose in due time. You will have to choose in due time. But you will have to have chosen that yourself, parents, and hopefully you chose the right path yourself. Children need to learn the benefits to right choices, the consequences to poor choices. The third problem that Israel ran into there was that they were seduced by an ungodly, sensual lifestyle of idolatry. You see that in particular, the warning of that in Deuteronomy chapter 7. If you want to turn there with me, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just to highlight that, Deuteronomy chapter 7. He talks about when you get into the land, you shall utterly destroy those people. Make no covenant with them. Show no favor to them. Do not intermarry with them. They will turn your sons away from following me. And then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you. So tear down their altars. Smash their sacred pillars. Hew down their fertility goddesses, their asherim. Burn their graven images, because you are a holy people to the Lord. The people has chosen you to be a people for his own possession. That's pretty strong language there, isn't it? Well, and Israel didn't listen to it either. They decided to do their own thing. And not surprisingly, having joined themselves to the world, they became ensnared by the world, and then they fell just like the world fell. So the lessons are here. It's all spread out there throughout the Old Testament if you want to take time to look. You cannot destroy the world around you. God doesn't ask you to do that. But you certainly can and must remove the ungodliness from your own home. Don't bring the world in and then start feeding it to your children. This is something that you cannot allow to happen. And parents, you can't allow it to happen for yourself either. Anyone who's here, you cannot allow this to happen. Start eating the filth and the sludge of the world. Because then those children, if you do this, will learn to conform to the world and justify godless behavior. And by the way, when you bring the world into your home, it undermines everything that we're doing here. All the lessons, the songs, the Lord's Supper, Christian fellowship, all here is undone by that which you're doing at home, which negates all the good that we're trying to do here. So imagine a child, for example, who's coming of age here, and he is at home, and he's doing things that his parents have allowed him to do that are ungodly and unchristian in every way. And then he comes here, and he hears a sermon by myself or someone else, and he sees us singing songs of praise and holiness to God and everything else, all these other things. What do you think he's going to do? How is he going to reconcile that? He's going to gravitate to that where he spends his most time, his greatest investment, and that will be in the home life, in what he's learning at home. It won't be here. How can you bring worldliness into your own home? What must you avoid? Again, this is not limited to parents with children, but all Christians. First of all, making amusement and entertainment your highest priority. What effect is that going to have on your children or on the family or on your own mind? If you're sitting in front of a screen for recreation for 15 to 20 hours a week, like a lot of people do, by the way, and you say that that's not a problem, you're living in delusion. You are deceived. Imagine me saying, well, I drink 15 to 20 beers a week, but I'm not an alcoholic. Well, I have deceived myself here, okay? I mean, it's just, we could do all the semantics and the wordplay and all that sort of thing. It's just not going to work, though. Allowing your children excessive access to the internet. I've mentioned this before, even with all the controls, there is a lot of bad stuff out there. I liken surfing the internet to spending time with ungodly, mentally unstable, sexually perverted people. Would you like your children to spend time with those in person? I mean, if we had a crowd of those kind of people, would you feel comfortable? Oh, hey, Junior, why don't you go spend time with this crowd of mentally unstable, sexually perverted people? And you say, oh, absolutely not. I wouldn't dare do that. That's exactly what you're doing when you just give free access to the internet to your children, because that's what's out there. I'm not saying it's all like that, thankfully, but that's out there. Allowing the TV and the video games with gratuitous violence and mature situations, sexuality, foul language, all this is doing is desensitizing your children to the bad effects that they're seeing all the time and implying that this is normal and acceptable. And then once again, then they hear the sermons and they're going like, oh, what do I do? What the sermons say or what I'm used to doing with my friends on the video game? I think I'm going to go for the video game because that's where I spend my most time. And that's where my friends are anyway. Allowing feelings to be more valuable than truth or moral responsibility or hard work. You know, this is where we have the parents who don't want to upset their children's feelings, so they remove them from what allegedly causes those bad feelings, like those kids doing something that they don't want to do or having to spend time with old people, you know, people in their 40s and stuff like that, as opposed to their peers, or having to do chores or getting their hands dirty. Well, this is what godless parents do. They shelter and shield all their children from what it means to be an adult, and then they throw their children out into the adult world in due time and expect everything to go well. It just doesn't work like that, and you should know that. How are we going to train disciples of Christ if we can't even train them to be disciples of our own home? How are we going to do that? Or they don't know or approve of their children's friends, especially those they're spending a lot of time with. It's not a matter of being nosy. It's a matter of being concerned. You're not responsible for your children's friends, but you have a responsibility to your own children. Even if you're not the popular mom or dad on the block anymore because of it, don't worry about that. The children will get over that. That's not your job anyway. The point I'm making here is if you allow your children to watch any movie, read any book, listen to any music, have any kind of friends, choose any form of entertainment, especially in a so-called Christian home, and what kind of Christian parent are you? And what kind of Christian environment does that produce? It just doesn't work, is what I'm saying. And I know some parents, they get emotional, defensive. I trust my children. Let's talk about trust just for a moment. Trust is an earned privilege. It is not a given. It is certainly not an entitlement. It's not about failing to trust your children as much as it's keeping them from the dangers and temptations, the situations that they're just not mature enough yet to handle, or maybe should never have to handle it all, especially in their own home. Over time, trust can deepen, but it has to be proven first. I know, because I was a teenager, I know how it goes. Many teens, when their parents start asking questions, they start saying, "You don't trust me." Sometimes this is a form of evasion. Like, I don't want you to ask any more questions because you're probing a little too deeply right now, and I'm going to be unveiled here as far as what I'm really doing. Or it's just simply a sometimes deliberate, misrepresentation of the situation. You know, I want to blow this thing out of proportion here and talk about something that's really not going on so that you won't, once again, pay attention to what really is. The fact is, you should not, and I stress this, you should not trust any child of any age who refuses to be held responsible and held accountable for his or her own actions. If the children cannot be trusted in little things, in a controlled environment, in the controlled circumstances of your own home or even this congregation, then how in the world are they going to be trusted in the bigger circumstances of being outside of your control and outside of your view and into the world itself? Even Jesus says in Luke 16, if God can't trust you with small things, small responsibilities, how in the world are you going to be ready for bigger ones? And that just makes sense. It's hard enough to pass the baton, even under ideal conditions. There's so many variables. There's so many dynamics of human nature. Historically, the convictions and passions of the first generation often fade and are forgotten by the third generation. And here's the thing. Even though we may preach the same message, it's not the same people receiving it. There's a different mentality, a different outlook, a different society, a different world. The world I grew up in as a child is far different from the world my kids grew up in. Even where I'm at right now, or I should say where I was at my daughter's age, in her mid-20s there, where I was at in my mid-20s is a very different world than where she's at right now. So she's hearing it differently. My son is hearing it differently. I expect that. I understand that. But I don't change the message for that. Okay? I don't change the message. Many churches are responding by changing the message, changing the doctrine in order to appeal to those kids, and that is exactly the wrong approach altogether. What we need to do is provide the same message, the same doctrine, but when necessary, different packaging. Maybe we need to find new methods, new ways to approach our young people. That's fine. We can find new ways to approach them, but we can't change what we approach them with ultimately. Can't change the gospel itself. The congregation does its part in instructing parents, but we are not a replacement for parents. If parents do not do their part, then the odds of children becoming lifetime believers decreases substantially, regardless of what the congregation offers. So how do you build this family environment, this baton to hand off here? Chuck Swindoll, in his book, The Strong Family, surveyed 3,000 strong, godly families, at least in his opinion, who were trying hard to pass the baton. He found 6 things in common. Just want to briefly touch on these. First of all, he found families that are committed to the family. Kids need to value and, as they're older, contribute to the strength and welfare of the family. Their own family, your own family, must be the most important group of people in the world to you and to your children. That doesn't mean you snub everyone else. That doesn't mean that. But that there are boundaries and priorities is really all we're talking about. Not isolationism, but rather just protection for yourself. We can go so far, but we can't go too far. You know, we can give so much, but we can't give too much. We can, you know, do a lot for other people, but we're not going to sacrifice the family in order to do that. I'm not going to sacrifice the children or the marriage. They also spend quality time together, the emphasis being on the word quality, placing meaning and value on time spent as a unit, as a family. That involves personal interaction. It involves problem solving and doing things together. My son was always saying when we were growing up, you know, because we do stuff as a family, and he really, really liked it. And so guess what? When we had some free time, he would say, Dad, let's do stuff as a family. And that would always be his phrase, as a family, because he really enjoyed that as a family unit, when we come together and do things together. Watching movies together or everyone on their own phones, scrolling through Facebook together, that is not quality time. And the reason is because there's no interaction. Everyone's in their own little world, and the focus is on something outside the family, not on the family. What we did, here's my list for what it's worth. We played cards. We played games. We went camping and fishing. We went hiking and bike riding. We had bonfires and weenie roasts. We picked up litter on the side of the road several times for the city. We went on road trips and vacations together. We watched home movies together. And that's a little different because now we're watching movies about us. we're directly involved in us. This is our history. This is who we are. We went to Veterans Day celebrations. We went to Memorial Day, the cemeteries on Memorial Day, I should say, and just simply talked about, well, the meaning of life and death and resurrection. We spent a lot of time at my mom's property. She had 10 acres out there near Eatonville, and we have a lot of good memories from doing that. I asked Honey and the kids what they remember, and a lot of overlap there. Honey also mentioned the bookstore in Anchorage. We spent a lot of time there as a family just listening to live music. We went on a lot of picnics, and birthdays were a big deal there that we celebrated together. Larissa remembers sledding, acting out Bible stories at home, going to McHugh Creek and Beluga Point. These are places outside of Anchorage there, playing on the railroad tracks and down by the water. I know that sounds dangerous. But I used to play on the tracks too there, and it was actually a lot of fun. I want to quote from Larissa because this is really worthwhile. She says, things that were interactive and didn't necessarily take a lot of planning or preparation or money were honestly the most fun for us. I think that really sums it up. It doesn't have to be a big production. You don't have to lay out a ton of money. You just have to spend time where it's important. And unfortunately, I asked Logan what his thoughts were. The first thing he came up with was spanking. And I said, son, how can spanking be a family event? And then Larissa says, well, I was listening outside the door every time. So. I think they missed something there. I told him to be serious, and he came up with a lot of stuff we came up with. And then also watching the Northern Lights, we did that together as often as we could. Spending time at the airport, back when you could spend time at the airport, climbing Flat Top Mountain, which is right outside Anchorage, and just a beautiful, wonderful hike, and it just gives you a 360 panoramic view of all around Anchorage and that whole area there, just gorgeous. And we did that quite a bit as a family. You often cannot create quality time without spending quantity of time. In other words, what might seem like an awesome memory to you might not be so for the kids. But the more time you spend together, the powerful bonds are going to be created as a family. And the kids are going to remember that and the importance of that. Good family communication is also extremely important, not just mere chit-chat, although the dinner table can be a real good time to really learn about each other. And that's why families should be eating dinner together. That's my strong appeal. Don't just grab your plate and go run into and sit in front of a TV or everyone in front of their own laptop or screen. What kind of family involvement is that? Sit down at the table. Turn everything off. Create an environment in which it is easy and natural to say whatever needs to be said without being criticized, without being shut down, without being disregarded. Create a safe haven then for your kids in your own home. The parent-child relationship does need to be maintained in that context. In other words, I don't become my child's buddy and they don't become my equal, but I do become, as a parent, a confidant and someone who knows my son and daughter better than anyone else on the planet and has their best interest, and they have my trust. I strongly advocate family meetings where dad is, for all intents and purposes, the judge. He has the final say, the final verdict. But all the members of the family are allowed to bring up problems or grievances or things that are not working or maybe suggestions. Have an open dialogue and have those things as often as is needed. Maybe once every couple months, maybe a couple times a year, whatever it takes there. The point is that you can't just have a bunch of people that live together with unintended random spurts of communication. You have to be working toward a certain goal, working together toward who you are as a unit and what is important. What are our family values? And then toward each other. In other words, show concern for one another. And that goes to the next point. These strong families express concern and appreciation to each other. Children need to be taught, because it's not natural with them, they need to be taught how to appreciate and show gratitude for their parents, for their grandparents, and other family members, as well as the church family and even adults in general, especially for their own immediate family. They need to be taught that you are to be grateful for what you have. Children left to themselves, everyone knows this, because we were there ourselves, we're selfish by nature. There's that what's in it for me. And there's a time for that, honestly. Even when it comes to teaching the gospel, someone says, well, what's in it for me? That's a good question. You just can't stay there forever. Okay? But initially, that's a good point. You have to look beyond that, though, In other words, the kids need to realize that the home, the meals, the clothes, you know, all the things in their bedroom, they did not just magically appear. You know, dad doesn't just go off to work and then magically there's money in the account. I mean, there's work that has to be done. There's things that have to be done. There's repairs that have to be made. You know, there's things that have to be purchased, and it doesn't just happen by magic. So the kids need to see that. And then when they get older, they need to actually participate in that. And all this appreciation for each other begins with the parents, in the conversations of the parents, how the parents treat each other, in their prayers even. What they say to the children must communicate a need for gratitude. Because as you know, ungrateful children turn into spoiled brats, and spoiled brats turn into spoiled adults. And then when spoiled adults get married, they usually marry other spoiled adults, and then they start breeding. You see where this goes? So it's not very good for the future if that's what we're creating and contributing to. We want to produce grateful children who will end up becoming hopefully grateful adults. But if the parents are negative and bitter and complaining and gossiping all the time, you can be sure that the children are listening and becoming all those things as well. You have a big impact, parents, on what happens. Deep spiritual commitment does not mean just going to church and reading the Bible, although those are good things, but really knowing what the foundation for your family is. The strength, the prosperity, the success of the family is not because of mom and dad or because of their jobs or because of their income or because of your material possessions or because of your personal talents. The strength of the family is because God is there and He is taking care of us. He is a shield, our protector, the source of our prosperity. Let godless families do what they will, but as Joshua 24:15 says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. This cannot be just something that you say or sing about or claim as a personal motto. It has to be, parents, something that you live by and something that you entrust to your children. We had the reading there. Daniel gave the reading, Matthew 7, verse 24 through 27, that we are to choose a wise foundation for ourselves personally. You can see how that can be extracted to refer also to a family and a congregation. If we build on a wise foundation, then we're going to survive the trials and the storms when they come against us. That's not a children's story that Jesus gave. That is true for life. We're told in 1 Corinthians 3, verse 11, Paul says, no man can lay a foundation other than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Well, what he means there is that you can lay a different foundation, but it won't last. It won't be any good. There's only one foundation that is worth laying, and that is the foundation of Christ himself. Again, this is true for families as well as it is for congregations, which is the context Paul is talking about here. All other foundations, whatever they are going to fail in time. And then this last one, able to solve problems in a crisis. Life is filled with crises. Some of them are small, flat tire, scrape on the knee. Others are difficult, sometimes even tragic. Life-threatening illness, house fire, serious car accident, death in the family. It can be some pretty serious things that life can throw at you. It is not necessary, here's my strong advice, it is not necessary to shield and shelter your kids from all of these things, nor how you, Christian parents, deal with such things. In fact, they need to see you under pressure. They need to see you facing trials. They need to see you solving problems. How do you expect them to do so if you don't show them how and train them how yourself? They need to see that age appropriately, of course. You don't drag a 2-year-old out and show them a car accident and say, well, see, what do you get from that? you want to be respectful of other age there and what's going on. But if you are solving all your children's problems, if you're the one solving their problems, you're being that helicopter parent or lawnmower parent, then they are unprepared for what is coming. And quite frankly, life will not care that they're unprepared. And life will not care that you didn't take the time to prepare them. Life will just chew them up and spit them out like it does so many other unprepared people. That's just reality, and you should know that. It's okay to let them fall now. It's okay to let them face rejection now when you're there to coach them through that and help them to get over that in that controlled environment. Again, let them see what you're facing and show them how to handle those things, those difficulties, with dignity and courage and, yes, in faith, how to turn these things over to God and how they can turn that over to God as well. You need also to see that not all problems can or should be solved. I know we're in an environment now in our world where we think that with human ingenuity and enough creativity, we can solve any problem that exists. And the fact is, that's just not true. The acceptance of one's own circumstances that are beyond our control forces us to depend upon God. Think about what Paul said over here. If you turn with me to Philippians chapter 4, I know this gets quoted, at least part of it gets quoted a lot, but it's very true. He says in chapter 4, verse 12, he says, I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. In any every circumstances, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things. Really, I can do all those things through him who strengthens me. Teach your children that. It's a good way to guide you through life there. Because sometimes you'll have prosperity, and sometimes you won't. Sometimes things will be going really well, and sometimes they won't. And you got to be able to weather whatever things life throws at you. 2 Timothy, chapter 4 and verse 7, Paul says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. Hopefully every Christian parent will say that at the end of their own life. Hopefully every child here will be able to say that with confidence at the end of their lives. Yet Paul also said that he declared the whole purpose of God. And he said that I also provided a mentoring for anyone who would want to imitate him. In fact, he challenged people, imitate me as I also imitate Christ. In other words, I think what he's saying, put all that together, is before any giving of crowns, there is work to do. The crown will come in due time. Right now, there is work to do. We have not yet reached the end. In a relay race, it's not enough to run the race. You have to also hand the baton off to the next runner. The next generation, in this case, is really what we're talking about. We're not just handing responsibility, nor the problems or the mistakes or the consequences. We should be also handing opportunity. Here's an opportunity to serve the Lord. Think about that. Instead of just saying, well, you know, our problems, now they're your problems. Good luck with that. You know, and I think sometimes people get in that mode of thinking there. What you should be saying is, you know what? We had a chance to serve the Lord, and we have no regrets. And here, you have a chance to serve him too. And you will have no regrets if you do it rightly, do it well. So ask yourself, do I have a firm grasp of the baton in the first place? And am I preparing to hand that off? Am I teaching the whole purpose of God? And can I say to my children with confidence, imitate me as I also imitate Christ? Am I training up my child, my children? The church of the future is very important. But if the church of today fulfills its responsibility, then we'll leave a powerful legacy. We'll give the church of the future everything it needs to survive and to flourish. One more lesson in our series and we'll be done. But I hope that what we are saying takes root here. I hope you take it seriously. I hope that you do well with this information and that you take it to heart. If there's anyone here who is ready to become a Christian, maybe you've looked through the gospel and you've already made up your mind, this is what I want to do. This is a lifelong commitment, and it's a difficult one, but it's certainly worthwhile. And if there's anyone here that wants to come forward and put on Christ in baptism, well, we give you an opportunity, or for any other reason spiritually that we can help you with, come forward if you need to as we stand and sing the song Richard selected.